Right in it this week. No pre-yabbering. I don't want to know what you've been up to.
I haven't really been up to anything.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7Digital.
This week, Led Zeppelin, Apple Music, Foo Fighters and Brexit. It's the CMU Podcast, the week in music. Oh, I almost had it.
No, you didn't. There was nothing about that that suggested a good snappy slogan was going to be the conclusion of that sentence.
I could have just stopped it as the week in music.
You could, because that is sort of what the CMU Podcast is. Well, it's the week in music business.
Well, that's why I stopped. I was like, oh, that sort of misrepresents it.
Because although we do cover bits of artist news on the podcast, there are sometimes some big artist news stories that we do not even mention. Not even in the we didn't mention bit.
Yeah.
So perhaps the week in music would be incorrect.
Next week, I genuinely am going to think about it.
This could be the last edition of the CMU Podcast recorded within the European Union. Because, of course, by the time the next podcast goes out, the referendum will have happened.
Well, yeah, but we're not going to immediately leave.
Well, who knows? It's unprecedented, remember. For all of the bold claims both sides have been making, the fact is we do not know.
Well, we do know that we won't immediately not be part of the EU.
Hey, it's up to the EU. They may already have a big sort of wall.
What, Friday morning?
Yeah, in the coastline.
Right, see ya.
They dug a ditch and they've got a wall. And the minute the result comes in, who's to say? Big walls might shoot up and that might be it. It might all be over by the time the next podcast comes out.
That walls aren't a legally binding thing, are they?
Well, referendums aren't a legally binding thing under the UK constitution.
I know, which is a good thing really, isn't it?
So who knows what will happen? So yeah, by the time we do the next podcast, we will have voted. And who knows what will have happened. So that will be interesting to see. But we won't be able to talk about that on next week's podcast because we'll be recording it while the, what do they call them, polling stations are still open.
Yeah.
So we won't be able to talk about it on next week's podcast. And then the following week, there isn't a podcast like this. There will be a podcast, hopefully.
Yes.
Still organising that. But there'll be a special edition of the podcast, not this version of the podcast, because, 2 weeks today I'm going to be talking about copyright in Barbados.
We don't want to hear about your trip to Barbados.
So that's quite exciting. Quite looking forward to going to talk about copyright in Barbados.
Don't care about your trip to
Barbados. So if you're part of the Barbados music community, then come.
I'm sure a huge number of our listeners are.
To the Business of Music event that is happening there and where I will be talking about the business of music.
Maybe I'll come.
Well, maybe you will. You've got a rowing boat? Perhaps you better set off now if you're going to get there. So it'll be 3 weeks' time when we'll get to talk about the disaster that is the impending exit of the European Union, of the United Kingdom, of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. But that's something to look forward to, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're going to be coming back to Brexity things at the end of this podcast, though, even though we have nothing to say about where we're heading because we don't know where we're heading. But as you probably noticed from the little intro there, that hasn't stopped Andy Malt putting a Brexit slot into this edition of the CMU podcast with all the pop music related elements to the big vote.
Which there's been a surprising amount of.
Well, if you follow the Beef of the Week column, that's all it's been for the last 2 years, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's probably going to be again on Friday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we will come back to that at the end of this podcast from a pop music perspective, a bit of books fizz or not, as the case may be.
Not.
But that's not what we're going to talk about in this serious news bit of the podcast.
No, what we're going to talk about in this serious news bit of the podcast is Led Zeppelin, who are on trial.
They are on trial and actually...
And they're going to go to prison.
For all we've talked about this being serious, it has actually been quite an amusing court case so far.
It's only been going a few days.
The judge seems to think he's going to get this done in a week, which seems quite optimistic to me, but that was what he was saying when things kicked off earlier this week. So this is the big Stairway to Heaven plagiarism case, which I think we have talked about before.
We've certainly mentioned it.
On the podcast.
Yes, Led Zeppelin have been accused of ripping off a song. Not for the first time, although they've always managed to sell in the past. This time it's gone to court. So they are accused of stealing the beginning of Taurus by Spirit for the beginning of Stairway to Heaven.
By Led Zeppelin.
So allegedly.
This is one of these cases where it's like, how the hell did it take this long to come to court?
Yeah, because obviously Stairway to Heaven came out in 1971. Taurus came out in 1969. Neither of these are new pieces of music. It's the estate of the guitarist from Spirit who brought the case.
Yes, so that's Randy California, although that wasn't his real name. His real name was, remind me.
Randy Craig Wolf.
That was his real name.
It's not snappy.
So the fact that these two songs have definite similarities was brought up during his lifetime.
Yes.
And there are several occasions where he was asked about the similarities, and it seems that he was always very blasé about it and was never bitter about it, never suggested it should be litigation. So this dispute has occurred since he has died. So his royalties are now controlled by a trust, which is called the Wolf Trust. And it is a trustee of that organisation who have pursued this litigation. It's taken a while to get to court. Initially, it looked like Jimmy Page, Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin weren't going to come to court. They were going to ignore the paperwork asking them to come to testify, basically saying, we're not in your jurisdiction, we're based in the UK, this is a bit of US litigation. But in the end, they did show up, which is A, why there has been such big press interest in the case now that it has finally got into court, and also Jimmy Page's testimony was behind some of the humour and amusing developments that happened. Now, there are various different elements to the debate that is going on in court as we speak. And as we record this, another day of testimonies are going on. So what we're about to say won't be 100% bang up to date, but we are reporting this day by day in the CMU Daily. So keep an eye on the reports there. But the different elements of the debate. Well, first of all, there is the theme that ran through the Blurred Lines plagiarism case last year, which is that, OK, these two tracks are similar. If you put them side by side, you can definitely see the similarities. But what the case for the defence, for Jimmy Page and Robert Plant, are saying is, oh, but those similarities, it's not that one song rips off the other song, it's just that they both use the same, I think they called them musical building blocks.
Yes.
Was the term they used. They said these are common musical building blocks that you'll find in lots of rock music over the years. And it's just that both songwriters have taken the same building blocks and used that to construct their music, and that is why they sound the same. And most importantly, those building blocks in themselves aren't protected by copyright. The completed song maybe, but the little elements of the song which these two songs have in common can't be protected by copyright. That's what the defence are arguing. They haven't yet done it in court. They did in the sort of the pre-trial paperwork. It is what they will argue in court when we get to the copyright technicalities. Now, it's worth remembering that that was the argument used by the lawyers for Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams in the aforementioned Blurred Lines case.
Yeah, look how that went.
And it didn't go down very well for them when they argued, oh, it's just that these two songs have similar features of pop music. In this case, the defence lawyer for Led Zeppelin did point to a Beatles track, which it is known that Spirit used to cover in the early days when they were off performing live. And the Beatles track predates the Spirit track, predates Taurus. And he was basically saying, you'll find the same musical building blocks in the Beatles track as you found in the Spirit track, as you found in the Led Zeppelin track. And that's just the way rock music works.
It goes way back into classical music. This is just a series of notes that people use.
Which a lot of people said about Marvin Gaye's music, which obviously is what Blurred Lines, what Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were accused of ripping off. Various commentators went back into Marvin Gaye's catalogue and then further back into the sort of genres of music that influenced him and said, well, hang on a second, you can take that from there and that from there. So that's the copyright technicality part of the case, although the testimonies to date haven't really dealt with that. We had a bit of that in the opening addresses on day one of the case. But the testimonies so far have all been trying to work out whether Jimmy Page and Robert Plant were ever exposed to the song Taurus. Because Jimmy Page for certain has said in his testimony that he'd never heard this song until a few years ago when people online first started to put the two tracks next to each other, probably on YouTube, that's normally where these things start. And he's saying it was only when that started to be a conversation online and I think a son-in-law, he said.
His son-in-law, yeah.
Some family member put him in front of a computer. He was sort of confessing to being a bit of a Luddite when it comes to such things, but put him in front of a computer and said, oh, look what people are saying about your song. And he claims that that was the first time he had ever heard Taurus by Spirit.
Yes, and he said he couldn't really see what all the fuss was about, couldn't really see any similarity, even though if you listen to Taurus, I mean, a lot of people would come to Taurus after hearing Stairway to Heaven, and Taurus, as a result, does sound a bit like someone playing Stairway to Heaven really badly.
Jimmy Page did admit that he does have a number of Spirit records in his record collection, including the debut album from which this track, the Taurus, comes.
Yes.
Although he said he remembers buying some of the band's later albums, but he's no recollection of ever buying that original album. And he was sort of saying, I've got over 10,000 records in my record collection. A lot of people give me music. I don't listen to it. And just because it's there in my record collection, that doesn't mean that I'd ever heard this track until a few years ago, and certainly not in 1971 when I wrote Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah, and then the prosecution were saying, ah, but what about when you played live with Spirit? Surely you would have heard them then, because they were supporting them. And Jimmy Page was like, oh, we left before they played. And the prosecution was like, but you said in interviews that you were a massive fan of Spirit. And he said, oh, journalists will twist your words to say anything. So they played a recording of him telling a journalist that he was a massive fan of Spirit.
Well, perhaps not massive, but certainly definitely he said he was a fan.
He said, Spirit is a band I really love.
Well, there you go.
So that's close to a massive
fan. Okay, all right then. Massive fan.
And he said, I don't know why I would have said that.
So there are various events back in the late 60s when the legal representatives for the Wolf Trust claim that either Jimmy Page or Robert Plant or both of them would have been exposed to the song. So yes, there were the shows where they supported Spirit. There was also a gig in Birmingham here in the UK where one of Spirit was saying, oh, Robert Plant was definitely there. I had a conversation with him afterwards. We played pool. We'd hung out. We had a drink. He really enjoyed the gig. And then when the defence legal team then questioned him in court, he backtracked on a big chunk of that. And he was sort of like, well, he was in the building at some point on that night. So that's what a lot of the conversation has been on about so far, is trying to prove that the two main songwriters in Led Zeppelin, certainly the songwriters of this track, had heard this song before 1971, and various other people have been forward to testify to say that surely they must have been near or exposed to this track at some point. They also talked about the fact that in the early days of Led Zeppelin, they used to do a middle medley bit in the middle with various songs sort of glued together, including a cover of a different Spirit track.
From the same album.
From the same album. And so, that was sort of part of this case of, oh, admit it, you were a big Spirit fan. You always listened to these guys' records. And again, Jimmy Page was like, well, we just picked whatever people were into at the time.
Yeah, he said, we liked to chip a wink to what's hot, which is not a phrase I've heard before, but I think I might start using it.
Yeah, try and get that into conversation as often as you can. Of course, with copyright infringement cases, you can have, we've mentioned this on the podcast before, subconscious copyright infringement. So you don't actually have to prove that the person that you're accusing of nicking your song deliberately set out to do that. And obviously, in the Blurred Lines case, there was the interview where Robin Thicke said, oh, we went into the studio and I said to Pharrell, do you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to make a song a bit like Marvin Gaye's Gotta Give It Up, which was sort of...
It didn't help.
It was useful for the Marvin Gaye estate in that case. But you don't actually have to show that there was any intent to rip off a song, merely that they had been exposed to the earlier song before they wrote the song that you're accusing of being a rip-off. So they don't actually have to show intent to copy, just exposure to the song. And so that's why so much of the testimonies so far have been on...
Which I still think surely that just makes all songs copyright.
Well, it's the classic, when does influence become infringement debate, which I think we will come on to beyond the did they or did they not hear this song before they wrote Stairway to Heaven. The next big chunk of this case, I mean, the good old musicologists are yet to testify. They're always fun when they come on stand. And that will be where you get to the point of, well, just how similar are these songs? Can we say that the different elements that are in common are protected by copyright? Just like the Blurred Lines case, the case centres on the sheet music version of the songs, not the recordings of the song, because this is about the copyright in the song, not the copyright in the recording. And the principle is that the copyright protects the core composition, not how it turned out when we then recorded it in the studio. So all of that will come up as this case proceeds. It is too early to say which way it's going to go, because these cases in the US go before juries, and juries are very hard to predict. There was one person who was going to be in the jury who then confessed that they were a massive Led Zeppelin fan, so they quickly got rid of that person. So it is hard to know with juries which way it will go. You do sense that the judge is no fan of the lawyer representing the Wolf Trust.
Yes.
According to the Hollywood Reporter, on which day was it? It would have been on Wednesday. The lawyer for the defence kept objecting to things that the lawyer for
over 50 times.
Over 50 times the lawyer for the defence went, objection, because the lawyer for the Wolf Trust was bringing something irrelevant into the conversation, or he was bringing up something that had been agreed pre the trial would not be mentioned in front of the jury. And nearly every time the judge was like, rules with the objection. To the extent you sort of feel that...
There was one occasion when he said sustained before the lawyer had actually opened his mouth.
Yeah, presumably saw a bit of body language. So you sense that the judge is not a great fan of the lawyer for the Wolf Trust. But obviously it's not ultimately up to the judge, it's up to the jury. So we'll see how it goes. It's interesting that obviously cases in America are famous when celebrities are involved for becoming a bit of a media circus, and sometimes cases they let the cameras in and they cover it in a much more open way than we would have over here in the UK. But that's not really happening with this case. You know, it isn't being streamed, it isn't being filmed, it's being tried in a relatively small courtroom. Sometimes when that happens, they then have a feed into a courtroom elsewhere in the building for all the journalists and the other people who want to see it. That's not happening.
No.
To the extent that there are no seats available in the courtroom, apparently there's a big queue outside of people who want to go in the public gallery. And the rule, certainly on day two, there were so many people there, was once you were in, you couldn't leave. If you just nipped out to the toilet, they give your seat to the next person in the queue.
Even if you left your stuff in the room.
Even if you left your stuff on the chair, that would not be enough.
And you're not allowed cameras...
No cameras.
Or pens,
well,
because pens might have cameras in
apparently.
Them.
Apparently. So no cameras, therefore no phones, because of course these days every phone is also a camera, so they're being very strict on no phones. But then on day one there was something about, oh, well, your pen might have a recording device in it, or camera. I don't know which pens have...
You can get pens that have recording devices in them.
So the rule on day one to all the journalists...
I mean, it would be obvious if it did.
Because obviously you can't have tablets or laptops in there because they would have cameras in them. So everyone's back to notepads. And on day one, it was you had to bring a pencil with you in order to get into court. But apparently, eventually they said, all right then, providing it's a really basic Bic biro type pen, we'll let you in with the pen.
I imagine it's a bit like the scene with the journalist in His Girl Friday. If you haven't seen that film, sure, go and watch it.
I haven't, but I'm imagining it.
Classic... like 40s journalists running out of the courtroom and running to the phone to file their story.
To file
good.
Their story.
I wish it was still like that.
Was there a lot of lawyers saying, objection? That is sort of a classic film court scene, isn't it?
Probably
with a,
does
with
have
a tetchy lawyer.
It's not really what the film's about.
Shouting objection a lot. So anyway, interesting case, quite an amusing case. Robert Plant yet to take to the witness stand, although he is going to. So it'll be interesting to see how this turns out and how bizarre the statements are that are delivered by the musicologists turn out to be.
Yes, I'm sure there will have been more of that by the time you hear this. So keep up with it via the CMU Daily.
Yeah, and if you're not a CMU Daily subscriber, sign up at cmusignup.com. Ah, little plug there. That was good, wasn't it?
Good work. Apple Music now. You remember Apple Music?
I remember Apple Music.
Right, that was that thing that you signed up for 3 months and then
I did.
Turned off.
Well,
yes.
I upgraded the Apple Music app on my phone and suddenly it was there. And then I was one of the clever people that worked out how to stop it charging me after 3 months.
I told you how to turn it
you
off.
You did. I remember.
I was the clever person.
Well done.
I Googled it. Anyway, it's been... 15 million people haven't turned it off. That's one of the things we learned this week. 15 million people are now
paying
for it, apparently. And it's being revamped so that those people are able to use it without getting annoyed.
So all these updates are coming a year on. So Apple Music, a year old now, more or less, give or take. And Apple had its big worldwide developers conference. Is that what it's called?
WWDC.
I think it's conference, not Congress. So they had their big event, and part of the big event, we had anticipated this, that there would be an Apple Music section. We had the stats brag. So they're now up to 15 million subscribers. Obviously, on Apple, you only have, well, you either have people on the 3 month free trial or paying subscribers. There is no freemium level. And so 15 million is pretty damn good. I mean, obviously, it's a lot less than users than iTunes has.
It is. I mean, it is. But then again, as we've said before, given that if you open the music app on your iPhone, it says, do you want a free trial to this service? Actually, it seems a bit crap.
And it would be interesting to know just how many people have done the free trial and then called it off. I don't think, although at various points we have been given the figure, including the people on the free trial, I'm not sure we've ever been told in total how many people did the free trial and then did not sign up at the end. But I suppose in terms of the subscription streaming market, Apple Music now very much the second biggest after Spotify. And although still some way off Spotify, even just with the paying subscribers, ignoring all the free users on Spotify. I mean, they are both growing at a very fast rate, and it seems that Apple Music is growing slightly faster than Spotify. So it could be at some point that they'll meet. and then they'll become sort of pretty much the same size. So we got the stats brag this week, but more importantly, we were expecting that there would be some changes to the Apple Music app, and actually there have been some rumours around for the last month that beyond having some little tweaks here and there, actually what was going to be announced at WWDC was quite a significant revamp of the entire Apple Music experience, and I think that is pretty much what we got.
Yeah, so the Connect feature, which was always a terrible idea, the music-focused social network within Apple Music has been, it's still there, I think, but it's been pushed right down to the bottom so that you really aren't going to see it. They've added lyrics, which is apparently something that people want.
People like singing along, don't they?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. But, I mean, you can do that anyway. But anyway, lyrics, that's a thing. And they've made it easier to see the things that you've downloaded from iTunes.
Which was one of the criticisms
yes.
of the app when it first launched. And I suppose there is an element of, you know, the Apple Music app, when it launched a year ago, launched to such massive hype just because it was Apple, and then Taylor Swift pushed it onto the front pages of every single newspaper in the world with the spat over whether or not royalties would be paid during the free trial. But I suppose that does mean that for a brand new app, it put huge scrutiny on it. And I think there were many weaknesses with the Apple Music app when it launched. I think we talked about them.
I think we did. On
the podcast. And almost, you sort of felt there was an out-of-characteristic, if that's the right way to say it, humility amongst the Apple execs with the revamp in basically saying, we know there were problems with version 1 and we're addressing a big chunk of those in version 2. So it's not that these are super duper new things that we're layering on top. This is basically us sorting out the bad stuff from the first iteration.
Yeah, they said it'd been redesigned from the ground up.
But I suppose if you were a startup in the streaming music space, so like Spotify and Deezer were back in the day, or like Tidal was in its WIMP era, you have that first 2-3 years where you don't actually have very many users to get things right.
Yeah, so Spotify's mobile app was rubbish for years.
So by the time millions of people are tuning in, you've had plenty of years to fix all of those things and to make it good. Whereas Apple, from the word go,
you're expected to be good.
You're expected to be good. Even though, actually, I mean, although Apple's devices are generally brilliant and their operating system is generally really good, when it comes to software, it's much more of a mixed bag
yeah.
from Apple. They're not particularly known for always being spot on with their software.
I mean, they've never
products.
Managed to make iTunes good, have they?
No, exactly. The store has never been brilliant. I mean, the fundamentals were good at the start in terms of, you know, some of the things that other people were dabbling with in the early 2000s with downloads. They made it a lot simpler, but it was never a particularly fun experience, and it was never great for discovery, was it? It was good if you knew what you wanted, but not something you'd go and hang out in. So yes, they said that what they've done with Apple Music now, it's all about user experience, it's about trying to make it more intuitive. They've looked at the stats. They have put the elements of the service that more people use to the foreground, the stuff no one's interested in to the background, including Connect, which was their attempt to, in essence, add an extra social network to every artist's digital to-do list by having updates from the artist, which no artist ever do.
Because no, Ellie Goulding.
Because no fans are interested. So Connect is still there, but it is lower down. Beats 1 has also been refreshed in terms of the interface, less so what's going out on air. Although some people did speculate that one of the announcements this week would be the launch of Beats 2, Beats 3, Beats 4, Beats 5, or maybe not all of them, but another Beats channel, because we know that they've registered those names. The fact that they call Beats 1, Beats 1.
Well, yeah.
Would suggest that there are going to be other channels coming down the line. And for all they made their big hoo-ha about Beats 1 being the first global radio station, I mean, it is very much a radio station made for, UK and US
yeah.
listeners. It's not a radio station designed for the world. So you would imagine other stations are still to be coming. But that was not part of the announcement this week with Apple Music.
Now, a couple of other side things that happened this week that are Apple-related. They reduced the Apple tax. So this is the 30% fee that Apple takes if the developer takes any sort of subscription or in-app payment through something on iOS.
And that announcement came pre-WWDC,
yes, yes.
So that was sort of slipped out before the big conference. And the Apple tax, obviously any app developer who takes money through the app has to pay Apple 30%. Nobody likes that, but most startup apps, well, you just build that into the business model. You're going to have to give 30% of the money to Apple. It's a really big problem for the streaming music services,
yes.
for the Spotify's and Deezer's.
When they're already handing over at least 70%
yeah,
of
exactly.
their income.
I mean, their profit margin is 30%. Actually, their profit margin at the moment is closer to 15%, but their best case scenario profit margin is 30%. So basically, it would involve operating at break even at best. And so what they do is they add the 30% on top, which means that if you subscribe to Spotify through the app, rather than subscribing through their website and then logging into the app, using the logins from the web, it's £3 a month more expensive. It also means that through in-app purchases, Spotify looks like it's £3 more expensive than Apple Music. And so Apple are basically now saying they're still going to charge 30% for new subscriptions, but if you keep a subscriber for more than a year, they're going to cut it to the 15%, which you might think would make Spotify happy.
But no.
No.
No, because they're still unhappy about the restrictions that Apple places on subscriptions. So, well, particularly that you can't communicate to someone going through your app that they could be getting a subscription cheaper.
Yeah, big button that says, don't subscribe here. Go to Spotify. And the Google App Store for Android apps allows more flexibility on communicating and signposting people to the fact that there is a better deal online.
You also can't do flexible subscriptions. So Spotify at the moment is getting in a lot of users by offering special offers like 99p for 3 months or whatever. And you can't do that on iTunes. So they have to charge $12.99 regardless.
And they were also saying that when they sign people up through the app rather than directly through their own platform, they get less data, basically, less information. So they can't make the product more attractive to the consumer at the other end, because Apple basically is always sitting between them and the customer, which obviously is Apple's intent.
Yeah.
Because they want the customers. They don't want Spotify to have the customers. So, yeah, that was an interesting development and an interesting response.
Yes, there was also another artist dissing YouTube.
But this is Apple Music relevant because...
Because it's Trent Reznor, who is Apple Music's creative director.
And so this happened at the press conference that followed the upgrade to Apple Music, and it was Billboard that said to Trent Reznor, after he'd stopped talking about Apple Music, what do you think about YouTube? Because, of course, lots of artists have been very vocal in criticising YouTube of late, mainly because the US record industry has joined the European record industry in making YouTube dissing its top priority, and they've pulled in lots of mainly older artists. Not so many young artists are joining in with this, but people sort of Trent Reznor's age are leading on this. And so, obviously, he's biased because he works for one of YouTube's competitors. But he said...
He found YouTube's business to be very disingenuous. It was built on the back of free stolen content, and that's how it got big. YouTube obviously came back and said, we're not built on stolen content, and look, we do pay people, and is mostly licensed, so shush.
Yeah, mostly licensed, and then
then he branched out. He said that he thinks that any free-tiered service is not fair. So that's a dig at Spotify,
it
mainly.
Is. So well done, Trent, for getting a little Spotify dig into your answer to a YouTube question. So lots of Apple Music developments this last week. Still not a subscriber. Are you a subscriber?
No.
But who knows? Perhaps one day I'll sign up. OK, time now for the CMU approved slot on the CMU podcast. Andy Malt has been busy approving music. You insist on improving music.
Improving?
Approving.
Approving. I thought you said improving.
No. You don't have the skills for that.
That's true.
But you just about have the skills to randomly pick a record and write some nonsense about it.
Nothing random about it.
There isn't. There's some big time curation, talent discovery, A&R expertise employed.
I listen to a lot of
shit music.
Terrible music to
desperately
find four that I like.
Four good tracks a week. So let's find out of all of that shit, what were the four passable songs that you discovered this week? And we begin with N's...
Nazca Lines. Don't embarrass yourself.
Yeah. How do we say this?
Nazca Lines.
Nazca
obviously.
Lines. NZCA Lines. Can they not just write Nazca out if they want it to be Nazca?
No.
I don't like these people already. But tell me about their music.
Well, they've got this track out.
You have?
Called Oh! Call Me Back.
So this is to do with the Meltdown Festival.
Yeah, which is going on till Sunday. If you're listening to this in the first 3 days it's out and you're in London, you've got a chance to go and see some stuff at Meltdown. Was it Jimmy Page had to pull out because he was in court?
I think it was Robert Plant. Because he's more likely to be doing a solo show, isn't he?
So, yeah. So that's another thing that the courts have ruined. Anyway.
I don't know. I think the court case is more entertaining than anything he could do at Meltdown. But approve.
Anyway, so this track was commissioned by Six Music to coincide with Meltdown Festival, which is this year curated by Guy Garvey, Six Music presenter, or at least was. I can't remember if he still is now. And the track is made up of samples recorded around the South Bank in London, where Meltdown Festival is, and then lyrics that are sort of a duet with a guy standing on the South Bank waiting for his date and trying to get in touch with her, and she's still at home because she stood him up. Ah, poor guy.
So, worth checking out?
Yes.
Good. Next, Efter Klang are back.
Efter Klang are back. After playing their last ever show, they're now back. Although they were quite clear, despite very much billing their last ever show as like last ever show, they did say at the time, it's not really our last ever show.
They just felt it was time for a change and that required a break.
Yeah, they'd sort of become this band that did, like, they recorded albums with orchestras and then they toured them, and they were sort of, I think it was becoming a bit samey for them. So they went away for a while. They did some other stuff. They formed a new band. Now they've come back and they're doing an album with an orchestra, which they're performing live. But it's an opera, so that's what's different.
So they didn't go away for a few years and come back doing exactly the same thing.
No, it's slightly different.
It's almost the same thing.
But it's a collaboration with composer Carsten Fundel. And they've been performing it live, actually, for a little while now. They've done a recording of it, which is going to be released in August, I think, or November. One of those two. And they are going to be touring.
And they are
the
releasing this as Efter Klang, because they have had side projects or
A-side
projects.
This is as Efter Klang, and they are touring it early next year, including a show at the Barbican in London, which is where they always perform. So they'll be used to it, and it'll be very samey for them.
But that's actually quite some time away.
It is.
So you could be listening to this podcast next February.
Yeah.
And you could still book tickets to that show. That's how upfront this approved is. Hey, Danny Brown is back.
Danny Brown is back, and he's signed to Warp, and he is back with some more Warp-like music. So he released his last album, Old, in 2013. It was very good, and then he disappeared. Well, he didn't disappear. He's been around, but he's not been releasing anything particularly. And now, yeah, he's back. He's announced he's signed a new deal with Warp. He's got an album coming out later this year. He's released the first track of it, When It Rain, which is, as I said, quite Warp-friendly. Still very much Danny Brown. Still very much worth checking out.
Good. Thank you. And finally, how am I saying this? Pascal Pinon?
Sure, why not?
Is Pascal, that how you're pronouncing it?
I'm going to say Pascal Pinon.
Pinon.
I'll tell you one thing.
I'll go.
I'm not even going to attempt to say their real names.
I think you should.
No.
I think it's rude not to.
No, they're twin sisters from Iceland who have names that I am not going to attempt to say. But you can look them up if you want. They are back with their third album, which is coming out shortly. And the first track of it is called 53. That's the track I covered. So this is the first, as I say, they're twin sisters. So they've generally, and they've been making music since they were like 14. And they've generally obviously been around each other a lot and been able to make a lot of music together. But since they released their second album, one of them's gone off to the Netherlands to study classical piano. The other one's been busy with her other band, Samaris, who you've probably heard. And so they haven't had a lot of time. And so this album has been very much, it's been dictated by their lack of connection rather than their connection.
And they feel that that's had an impact on both the songs and the recording of those songs.
Yes, well, in terms of, you know, the song, it was written over a year and a half for them kind of travelling back and forth between their respective now home countries when they could. And then when it came to recording it, they could only actually fit 2 days in. So they recorded the whole album in 2 days, which I guess gives it a certain roughness. It's very sort of, it's quite a sparse folk. It seems quite Icelandic, which, you know, is because they're from Iceland.
You would expect.
Go check it out if you want to listen to any of those, which you want to listen to all of them. You should go to completemusicupdate.com/approved.
Or click on the link and go and listen to the semi-approved playlist on the aforementioned Spotify, but not the aforementioned Apple Music. Sorry, Trent.
Foo Fighters now, and another lawsuit.
Yeah, a bit of insurance litigation here for you, ladies and gentlemen.
The best kind.
So that's quite exciting, isn't it? So this week, the Foo Fighters sued, well, they sued various people.
Yeah.
They sued Lloyds of London, the insurance market, several insurers who insure through the Lloyds of London market, and they sued their brokers, Robertson Taylor, so a well-known music industry insurance brokerage company. And they're basically suing over various insurance companies, in their opinion, reneging on their commitment to provide compensation for various shows that the Foo Fighters were forced to cancel last year.
Yes. So there were various reasons why they cancelled shows.
Two.
There were two reasons.
Reason one
was, as I'm sure everyone will remember, Dave Grohl fell over and hurt his leg.
Live on stage.
Live on stage. Broke his leg.
Yes.
Live on stage.
And that was it, because it was quite a dramatic falling off the stage. He was clearly very seriously injured. He then finished the show, didn't he?
He did.
Being Dave Grohl. But then after the show, got taken to hospital. And at that point, the doctors said, A, what an idiot for carrying on with the show. B, there's no way you can do the dates that are immediately coming up. So a number of shows were cancelled. But then he did actually get back on stage relatively quickly, not long after that.
Yes. Second was they had further European shows booked in November. So just after the Bataclan attack in Paris, which many artists cancelled shows. And so the Foo Fighters cancelled the last, I think, four dates of their European tour and went home.
Yes, and two of those were in France, one in Paris, I think, and then two others, I think it was Barcelona and Turin, so elsewhere in Europe. So although it's one bit of litigation with both of these disputes, in essence, the disputes are different, so the claims that the Foo Fighters are making are different. So if we start with the shows that were cancelled when Dave Grohl broke his leg first.
So those were two Wembley Stadium shows, and there was Murrayfield Stadium in Edinburgh.
And they cancelled those shows, and so they claimed on the insurance, because obviously when you tour as a big name artist, you have an insurance policy. So for some reason, including falling off a stage and breaking your leg, then you have insurance so that all of the costs, because obviously all the tickets have to be refunded, and so the losses associated with that, you go and claim from your insurance company. And so that is what they've done. Now, that the band were covered when Dave Grohl fell off the stage and broke his leg, that's not under dispute. But the issue is this. As I say, not long after all of that happened, Foo Fighters then announced a new tour. And there was that whole period where Dave Grohl was performing from a big throne, wasn't there? Because actually,
Axl Rose then went and
he
used.
Did, when he also injured himself. So Grohl got back on tour relatively quickly with the throne. And this has created an issue, because on that tour that then followed, they played some dates at Wembley Stadium and at Murrayfield Arena in Edinburgh. And so what the insurance company is now saying is, oh, well, the original three shows, they weren't cancelled. They were postponed, which might sound like mere semantics, but apparently in the terms of the insurance policy that the band have, that makes quite a big difference in what they will pay out based on a postponement versus a full cancellation. Because presumably if there's a postponement, the insurers are saying, well, actually, you made a big chunk of the money back when you did the subsequent dates. And so Foo Fighters are disputing the interpretation of those shows that subsequently took place. They're also being very critical of their broker. This is what they are alleging in the lawsuit. We've yet to have any responses from the other side.
They're saying the broker failed to properly advise them of this technicality.
Yeah, as the company that sits between the middle, they are sort of saying, well, Robertson Taylor should have made us aware that we have to be careful when we put these dates into our new tour, that they might be seen as being a reschedule, and that would impact what money we could get back from the insurance companies. So that's the gist of the first part of this dispute. When it comes to the shows that were cancelled following the attacks on Bataclan in Paris, there, it seems to be, well, they have a clause in their contract that says terrorist attacks resulting in a cancellation, that is included. And when you read insurance policies, they're always full of doom and gloom of all the terrible things that might happen. And that is listed in there. But it seems to be, well, as far as I can tell from the lawsuit, it's not that the insurers have specifically said, we don't think this line of the policy applies and we're not going to pay. It's that it's just taken an incredibly long time to find out what's going on. And what the band were saying in their lawsuit is, we just keep getting more and more and more and more questions. And it seems to be that the two French shows that weren't cancelled, those aren't being questioned, although it hasn't actually been said we're going to pay you and no money has been paid over yet. But there haven't been queries about the two French shows. It's about the show in Barcelona and Turin, which I don't think it's been explicitly stated, but the inference the band are potentially making is the fact you're asking us so many questions about these two other shows is, are you ultimately going to come back to us and say, well, OK, because of what happened at the Eagles death metal show in Paris, we accept that you couldn't play the French shows, but why did that stop you playing shows in Spain and Italy? Although a lot of artists, particularly US artists, did cancel multiple dates across Europe in the wake of those attacks. And so, as I say, the claim here, it doesn't seem to be the insurers have actually clarified what their intent is on that latter claim. But they're saying, well, A, we just keep getting asked all these questions. I think the lines they were using, this flood of increasingly irrelevant questions, and they just won't tell us, are they going to pay out? And if they're not, on what grounds? And then we might sue in that element of it. Two different but similar cases being pursued in one bit of litigation against Foo Fighters insurers. The other thing that was listed in the legal papers was the fact that Dave Grohl did get back on stage with his specially made throne meant that actually they would have cancelled way more shows.
Yeah, they saved the insurers a lot of money.
Exactly. There should have been many more cancelled shows by all rights. Most other artists would have taken a year off or 6 months off to recover from a broken leg, remember. It wasn't like a sprained ankle. And they were sort of saying, Dave Grohl, not for the benefit of the insurers, for the benefit of the fans, got back on stage way quicker than perhaps you would otherwise have expected. In doing so, there were less cancelled shows, which means the insurers saved millions and millions of pounds, and so they should play ball on these little disputes, was the sort of conclusion of that. I suspect this will be settled behind the scenes, and we may not hear any more of it, but who knows? Could get to court.
Just quickly, time to run through a few of the stories we haven't had time to talk about this week.
Including one that you said we were going to return
to. Well, exactly.
Properly.
Well, I assumed that we would, but who could have foreseen that Terra Firma bailed out in its lawsuit against Citigroup over the purchase of EMI?
So this is a very long-running dispute that we've covered in great detail in the CMU Daily. If you go to the timeline section on the CMU website, there's a little button in the sidebar for the timelines. There's a timeline of the whole EMI debacle and Terra Firma. This private equity firm bought EMI in 2007 with a massive loan from Citigroup. It all went horribly, horribly wrong. Ultimately, Citigroup repossessed. And then Terra Firma said, Citigroup in 2007 misled us before we bought EMI because they were working for both EMI and Terra Firma at the same time, which always seems a bit odd, but there you go. And the whole thing went to court in 2010 and Terra Firma lost. This was in the New York courts. A retrial was then ordered because it was, it was an English deal under English law, and it was decided that the New York courts hadn't enforced English law properly, which is why it was happening in London this time. 6 years on, Terra Firma and their boss Guy Hans seemed very keen to continue to pursue this. They were still clearly fighting. And then 4 days into the case, Guy Hans had given testimony where the lawyers for Citigroup were basically saying, well, this came up in the first case back in 2010. The argument was that the Terra Firma executives seemed to have very precise memories of the bad information Citigroup allegedly gave them, and really hazy memories about everything else that happened in 2007 around the EMI deal. And the lawyers for Citigroup kept saying that again with the new case, and it seems ultimately that the lawyers for Terra Firma said, you know what? We don't have a good enough recollection of what happened in 2007. Our evidence is not good enough for what is basically a fraud case. And so, yeah, for having waited 6 years to have their day in court, 4 days in, suddenly the lawyers of Terra Firma said, yeah, we're calling it all off. We're over that.
Yeah.
We're moving forward. So a very quick summary there of a story, which we assume is it now. We will never write about Terra Firma ever again. That whole horrible era of the EMI group.
I suspect that Terra Firma will never get back into music again. Ever.
So this is us drawing a line. We will never talk about that era of EMI ever again. Maybe. Hey, we're talking far too much about these stories that we're not talking about, but Twitter has confirmed that it has now invested in SoundCloud. Rhapsody is finally going to rebrand as Napster in the US. Oh, and you had a big story this week that we really ought to mention.
Yeah, Justin Hawkins from The Darkness has found his lost cat.
And you might be thinking that he'd only lost the cat like a fortnight ago, and therefore why is this news?
No, 3 years ago.
3 years ago. I mean, I'm still not quite sure why this is news, but, I mean, that is quite a long time to be without a cat for it then to turn up.
Yes, and it turned up in Lowestoft where it got lost.
So
they checked its microchip and his data was all up to date. And so he's reunited with it and now he's taken it back to Switzerland where he now lives.
So if you are a cat owner, make sure you have a little chip in the... It goes in the collar, is that right? I've never owned a cat.
It goes in the cat.
Oh, in the cat?
Yeah.
And make sure that once you've done that, you keep your information up to date, which is what good old Justin Hawkins from The Darkness, ever a king of admin,
yes,
has been doing.
Because he said even though it had been 3 years, he always knew the cat was still alive, which he didn't.
But so I'm looking forward to The Darkness concept album, all about the disappearing cat.
Yes.
And finally, we promised you Brexit news, even though this podcast is being recorded and going out pre the EU referendum. But nevertheless, there is some pop angles.
Well, we've talked before about Bepop Live.
We have. Remind us what Bepop Live was.
Well, Bepop Live was the big, depending on how you who you believed, it was the big non-partisan rally to enthuse young people to vote in the referendum.
So a sort of rock the vote type thing.
Yes, but it was being organised by people on the Leave side. It had only speakers from the Leave side at it, and it was endorsed by Leave EU.
Even though officially this was meant to be a non-partisan event, it seemed that it was very much swaying towards the Leave EU side, and that was the problem, because it seemed to me that whenever they booked artists, they weren't explaining, well, seemingly they weren't explaining it had a political element at all, and they certainly weren't explaining that the event was very closely affiliated with one side of this debate rather than the debate in general.
Yeah, so originally the event was supposed to happen in May, and they announced in like March or April or something, like a reasonably good lineup, like Sigma, Ella Eyre, a few other acts who like might enthuse the youth. But then some journalists got on the phone to all those artists and said, you know that this is being organised by Leave EU. And all the artists went, oh my God, and cancelled. And then the event was pulled. But it was rescheduled for June, 19th of June, so this Sunday. And they announced who they have on it. They had two members of Five and Alicia Dixon and E17.
Bearing in mind that throughout they were saying, not only is this event a non-partisan event about encouraging people to vote, it's specifically about encouraging young people to vote.
All of whom would love to see two members of Five, I'm sure. But they all can't. The same thing happened again. They all pulled out.
Yeah, so version one was all sort of current artists. Version two were all 90s artists. And then version three.
Version three, this is an event that's supposed to fill a 15,000 seat arena, let's not forget.
Preferably with young people.
They announced three former members of Bucks Fizz. And another guy whose name is conveniently Bobby. They had the Drifters, Alexander O'Neill, and an Elvis impersonator.
So big, big names. Plus, they still had their anti-EU politicians to do their little bits between the songs.
Nigel Farage was going to come and do a turn.
So that's that would have been good.
But then this week, they announced that it was being cancelled.
So it's not.
It's not because happening. The lineup wasn't good enough, though. You need to remember that.
No, I mean, there are presumably 15,000 very disappointed people who were really looking forward to three quarters
well,
of
Bucks Fizz. Well, they said they'd sold 8,000 tickets.
Whatever the current Drifters. I mean, that is one of those bands that has changed their lineup about 84,000 times, isn't it, over the years?
I think so, yeah. But they said they were going to have to refund 8,000 tickets. So, I mean, not sure who bought those tickets. Possibly people like me who said, oh, I might buy a ticket just to see if it happens. But they said it was actually, the problem was the event's £500,000 cost breached the Electoral Commission's rules on referendum campaign spending.
Despite it being a non-partisan event and not a campaigning event.
Yes. So it's interesting that in sort of giving the statements, Leave EU's PR, Andy Wigmore, has now become the event coordinator. So it's almost like they went, oh, yeah, all right, we were doing it. So they sort of it does look like they were just trying to pull the wool over the Electoral Commission's eyes all along. Go like, no, it's nothing to do with us. I'm sure, yeah, it's funded by the chairman of Leave EU, but that's nothing to do with it.
So that's all fun.
So that's all cancelled. The Electoral Commission said, we just looked into it. We never said you can't do it. We just said, can we have some information about this? And they've gone, ah, we're cancelling it. But yeah, Wigmore said it was intended as a huge and well-deserved thank you to all of our supporters, which is not what he's been saying at any point all along. But anyway, now it's not happening.
No Bpop Live, people.
So instead, we got some sort of weird mini naval warfare on the Thames.
Yeah, so no big pop concert around at the EU referendum, but there was a almost pop-related skirmish in front of the Houses of Parliament this week involving the aforementioned Nigel Farage.
Yeah, so Nigel Farage set out on a flotilla of boats manned by fishermen angry at
EU fishing legislation. And so this was timed to coincide, I think, with Prime Minister's question time in Parliament. So it was a big publicity stunt for the Leave EU campaign.
Yes. And then Bob Geldof set out on his own pro-in flotilla.
So he must have got wind of Nigel Farage's plans here. So then we ended up with two separate flotillas. When we say flotillas, are we talking about boats? As in two boats? Because a flotilla is lots
of
boats.
I think Farage had quite a few boats. Right. I think Bob Geldof had one, but there were quite a lot of people on it.
Right. So a very well populated boat. And what did anything happen?
There was a bit of a barney.
Shout at each other?
I think one of the boats on the Brexit side tried to board Bob Geldof's boat, and then the police got involved, and it was all very silly. I'm not really sure why fishermen are allowing Nigel Farage on their boats if they're angry, because Nigel Farage sat on the European Parliament's Fisheries Commission and then only turned up to one meeting in 3 years and failed to ever vote on the legislation, which would have improved the legislation. So
are you calling Nigel Farage a hypocrite?
I might be calling Nigel Farage a hypocrite.
On the CMU podcast?
Yeah.
Big, bold words there.
It just seemed a bit ironic that he was allowed on their boat.
If Private Eye is to be believed, there are two organisations who are pro-leaving the EU on there, so anti-EU. And Nigel Farage is part of the organisation which was organising Bebop Live. Leave EU, is that what they were called?
Yeah.
So they're one of the organisations. And then there's the other organisation, which is actually the one that has the official recognition, although the two are collaborating. And as I say, private eyes to be believed, the people in the Leave campaign on the two sides hate each other more than they hate the European Union or anybody on the Stay in Europe campaign. So if they do win, they will be the people who will be leading us forward. But hey, they've got boats, so that's always good.
Yes.
And if we all need to leave the country, at least there will be boats available. So that could turn out well.
Yeah, well, we'll see. This time next week, you might know, or you probably will know what's happened, but we won't when we record it.
So, yes, as discussed, yeah, at, the
as discussed at the start. I'm just bringing it back around again.
Just in case people have forgotten.
But so if you do think that the UK should remain part of the European Union, do remember to go and vote next Thursday while we're recording the podcast. If you think that we should leave, do remember that tweeting counts as voting. So just tweet about it. Although don't tweet us at CMU. We don't want to hear from you.
Look at that, CMU podcast taking a political position here.
Speaking of voting, you should subscribe to this podcast, which is a bit like voting.
It is a bit like voting. Rating us on iTunes would be more like voting.
And reviewing it too. I mean, do all three,
yeah.
I think. Subscribe, rate and review, and that will count as a vote for the CMU podcast.
Yeah.
And hopefully we will win out of all the podcasts.
Yeah, this week the end bit's almost as rubbish as the openings.
Should I just wrap it up?
Yeah, just wrap it up.
But you know, this podcast was presented by me, Andy Moore, and that guy, Chris Cook, which is a thing we did not say at the beginning. So it's lucky I'm saying it now.
Hello.
It's produced by Matt Peaty. For more on CMU and to subscribe to our daily news bulletin, do go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
Okay, time now for the CMU proved poo. I'm going to say that again.
What?